Hello, and welcome to episode 30 of the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here today with my co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, Perry. How's things?
Good, thanks. And we have a third person, a third part of the wheel today, and that's Lucy Sussex. Hello, Lucy.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm fine. I just did a trip to Ballarat on the weekend, and I'm now thinking, oh, well, COVID, I won't be doing that again for a little while.
No, look like we might be moving back into some tighter restrictions again, unfortunately. The state of Victoria has started to record a number of extra infections from a few people doing the naughty things and not taking care of social distancing and all the rest of it. But the one thing I wanted to ask you, Lucy, because you mentioned this on your social media platforms recently, that you've had a bit of trouble with the, shouldn't say trouble, trouble sounds a bit too rough, a little bit of difficulties with the doing some research in the State Library. What's going on there?
Well, it's simply that the State Library was one of the first places to close because they had an early COVID case. And given the way that tourists would come in and out and get photographed in the dome, it was fairly obvious that that would happen at some point or other. So they've closed. Now they've reopened, but at the moment they're working out the logistics of having people in and out and how they sanitise that. So you can't actually use books, which I personally find rather annoying. As theoretically, you should be able to. Rare books is one of the areas which I use, and that is actually controllable because you have to record who goes in and out. And I guess that if it's a question of sanitising the pages, well, there's no reason why you can't read a book in gloves if you're sufficiently adept. Rubber gloves doesn't cause that much problems. I note also that the archives of Victoria are now open, mainly because they've got heaps of space so that the people can socially distance there, and there's not much reuse of the same archival manuscripts. But they are working on it, and I gather that towards the end of the month they will, or very soon now, they will allow you access to the book collection. But it's just annoying if you're using material that's a bit out of the way and which is not available in electronically.
Mm. I went to my local library last week to actually return a few books that I took out in March prior to the lockdown. Yes. So luckily enough, they kept on extending it and not sort of hit me with a massive fine for bringing it in late. But dropped the books off, and the general rule was you had a short period of time to be in the library. If you picked up a book that you decided not to take, you actually had to put that book into a quarantine area where it would sit for 3 days. And all books that were returned are going to be sitting there for 3 days. I guess the view is that the virus, if it sits on a flat surface like plastic or cloth, if it's on there for 3 days, then that's enough of a quarantine and it should be dead by then. But I would have thought with the rare books, they could basically say, well, you've got it and nobody else can touch it for 3 days afterwards. And is it going to make any difference? But obviously not. They've got different rules. So anyway, it's a bit of bad luck.
I think it's just working out the traffic flow of people. But, you know, certainly you can sanitise a plastic-covered book, but it's a little bit more difficult if you're dealing with a hardback.
Yeah.
But never mind. It's a process, and they're working on it, I am told, because they got in touch with me and told me.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Mm. It's useful to complain loudly in social media at some stage.
Are you being impacted at all, David, at this stage?
No more than we previously were, except, as I say, I got an email this morning. I had planned to visit my mother at the aged care facility she's in, and even that was a sort of very careful arrangement where they take your temperature before you go in. You've got to fill in a questionnaire whether you've had any symptoms, and they take your temperature, and you go in and you sit across the width of a table, you know, quite a decent sized table, probably a 2 meter sized table, and but you can chat. So I've done that once, and I had planned to do it tomorrow morning, but alas, with the increase in number of cases in Victoria, then they've shut that down again. So instead, we'll be having a Skype call, which we've done in the past too. So
it looks like we're back to slightly more closer restrictions, which leads us to the point that this is now a good time to start looking at more books, more TV, more film. And to help people out today, we're actually going to be dealing with a particular topic. And I suggest that probably we get to that now. Today's topic is alternate histories, otherwise sometimes known as counterfactuals. Now, this is a subgenre of science fiction, but the whole concept of alternate histories has been around since the 1800s. It's generally based on a major historical event like a world war or American Civil War, assassinations of important people, deaths of important people, etc. And the idea is that these alternate histories explore what would happen in the event of a different outcome from that which we know in our current timeline. The general view is that Murray Leinster, the American science fiction writer, is credited with introducing the concept of science fiction in his story Sidewise in Time, which was published in Astounding in June 1934. In fact, there's now an annual prize, which is four alternate histories, stories, and novels, which was created in 1995, called the Sidewise Award, and that's named after Leinster's story. So there's the connection there. There have been a large number of works, alternate history works in the science fiction field over the last 100-odd years. Some of the major ones, some which may get mentioned in this particular episode, but some that probably won't. Bring the Jubilee by Ward Moore, which is based on the American Civil War, if there was a change in result. The Lord Darcy series by Randall Garrett, which is a favourite of mine, which is a set of murder mysteries set in England, where after Richard the Lionheart does not die in the Crusades but returns to England, so there's no King John and therefore there's no Magna Carta. So what happens if that all works? And there have been a couple that have recently, or over the last 10 or 15 years, won the major Hugo Award, namely the Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon, which theorises the Jewish settlement, rather than being in Israel after World War II, is actually in Alaska. And then last year's Hugo novel winner, The Calculating Stars, purports to show have a timeline where there is a large meteorite impact off the eastern coast of the US, and what happens to the space race and to the US after that happens. But today we're going to be considering only a small portion of the alternate history field. It's just too big to cover the whole lot. And today we're going to be dealing with alternate histories based around various events in the middle of the 20th century, so in and around World War II. The major sub-subgenre, if you want to go down to that level, for this particular set of works would be what if Hitler won the Second World War? Some of the works that we deal with today will be covering that particular topic, but not all of them. So without further ado, we've basically split up what we decided that we wanted to have a look at, and stories and novels that we were going to discuss individually. So we'll go to Lucy first, who has chosen. Well, what have you chosen, Lucy? Which
I've actually chosen what the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction calls the first What If Hitler Won book of any note, which is Catherine Burdekin's Swastika Night, which was published in 1937, and then, which, as you say, is only about 3 years after that Leinster book. That's Catherine Burdekin actually wrote under the pseudonym of Murray Constantine, and the book was chosen as a Left Book Club in 1940, so it was out by Golanx. It's quite likely that Orwell read it. It has been called 1984's Invisible Twin because it's positing a dystopic future. It's interesting because the author Catherine Burdekin published this Constantine, and her identity wasn't revealed for something like 20, 30 years, and then it was discovered by Daphne Partey, who did a fair amount of research into Burdekin. So that's her book. And the other one is Jo Walton, a more recent trilogy by Jo Walton, who's a Welsh author living in Canada. And that's the Small Change trilogy. But First Swastika Night is an extremely powerful book for many reasons. It's probably the major early feminist dystopia, in that it looks at Hitler's view of women as being only suited for, you know, church, children, etc., and posits from that. And so it sets a 700 years in the future. And Hitler has won the Second World War and created a feudalistic state. Most of the enemies have been eliminated in terms of race, but there is one major enemy that persists, and unfortunately they need it, and that's women. And it's taking a trend from Nazi thought. And it's, remember that Hitler subjugated the feminist organisations as much as he subjugated the Quakers, say, or the Seventh-day Adventists, or any groups that he didn't like, basically. And so it sets up a far futuristic world in which women are reduced to the status of animals, and they exist only to breed, and they're kept apart, and all male children are taken away from them at the age of 18 months. And so that has a state religion in which Hitler is exploded. So they're picking up on various Nazi paganistic school of thought, in which they thought that Christianity was tainted by Judaism, and so went back to the Norse gods. And so Hitler was born not of woman, but he's exploded out of the head of Thor. Odin, I think. And so he's believed to be a blue-eyed, 7-foot-tall, blonde messiah. And it begins with a church service in which they're celebrating it, in which having. And then, so the men go first and the women follow after. So what I want to point I want to make is all these, if Hitler won, they're all about very different things. And Burdekin's book is actually about misogyny, but it's also linked with homosexuality, in that, again, a thread, although suppressed within the Nazi belief, was very homosexual at first. And so the men are attracted to each other, following on the Hellenic idea that ideal relationships were between men, and that to love a woman was something lower. And so if you look at this book, it's extremely confronting for 1937, which is possibly why it wasn't a great success at the time, although people clearly thought highly of it. It's incredibly powerful. It's also very disturbing. I wouldn't say it's extremely quotable, but I wouldn't say that it's a fun read. It's a really confronting read. And if we're looking also at the status of this book, it's not underground anymore, but it is regarded, John Clute regards it quite highly in the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction. And so it's a major dystopia, and possibly the first of the feminist dystopias that looked at the subjugation of women. And so it's a direct ancestor of The Handmaid's Tale, although I can't say for certain if Atwood ever read it, although I would suspect she's aware of it. Not at all a light read, but an incredibly interesting one and intellectually rigorous. She takes the threads of Nazism and she goes, if this goes on, and she projects. Given the sort of limited amount of information that was around in the 1930s, she does an extremely good job. So that's one of the books I wanted to talk about.
That's remarkable that came out before the Second World War. Obviously, she'd picked up on what she was hearing from what was going on in Germany even to that point.
She had a friend whose husband was a foreign correspondent in Germany, and so he was becoming aware of things. In the same way, my father went to Nazi Germany in 1936 and seems to have met most of the Christian resistance to Hitler. But he left a diary in which he omitted their names in case the diary got read while he was still in Germany, but he knew exactly what was going on. But he clearly found the experience so traumatic that nobody ever knew the diary existed until after he was dead. So this is a book about trauma, continuing trauma, and I think that's what makes it so powerful.
It sounds like it's one of those seminal works that has been a bit lost, but now hopefully with people rediscovering these things and them being reprinted, that'll get a wider audience. So it sounds like one that they do have a read, David.
Indeed. It would be definitely worth having a look at.
Yes. So, Lucy, you're Joe Walton trilogy.
Yeah, this is a more recent one. Jo Walton's an interesting writer in that she never, although she's a fantasy, but she never writes the same book twice, probably to her publisher's annoyance, although she has managed several series. And this one is a really interesting book in that it's cross-genre. And according to Walton, she was reading Josephine Tay and trying to work out what year the book was set in, and they had the idea, well, this all these Golden Age fictions are in the period pre-war, Golden Age of detection. And what if you actually started writing if Hitler won, but in the mode of Golden Age detective fiction, which, given that it's an extremely popular genre, was quite an inspired choice. And so she went on, so she's got this, the trilogy is, they're called Farthing, Halfpenny and Half a Crown. And they've got, while you can say that Burdekin is about misogyny, what this book is also about, what Walton's books are also about, is English class system as a controlling mechanism. And class plays a big figure in these Golden Age books too. And so it starts out with what appears to be a country house murder, except that it's a meeting of a political action group who are largely aristocratic with Nazi sympathies. Unfortunately, the daughter of this titled household, coincidentally called Lucy, happens to have married a Jewish man called David, and David Kahn. And this is really not appreciated by the family, and invited to a big party, and one of the big wigs is murdered, and it would appear that suspicion is being cast upon David Kahn. What Walton has said is that if you are looking at the monstrosities of history, like Nazism, and if it's like a dragon anatomatized upon a table, if it's a case of Nazism, you can then look around and see that the dragon's relatives are standing around waiting to bite you. So it's a prodromic book. It's about warning. But the other theme of the book, in parallel with Burdekin, is homosexuality, because she has two narrators in every book, two point of view characters. One was always a young woman, and in the second book, Half a Crown, it's Halfpenny. It's hilarious in that this is a slightly transmogrified version of the Mitford sisters, who included, as is well known, two Nazis and a communist. Mm. So, on one hand, young woman, but also a police inspector who's like an investigatory figure and is drawn in the original murder. And he, you gradually realise, is gay, and at one point he is blackmailed into his silence. So the two themes is about how England, which has formed itself into allied itself with Nazi state, slides closely, sort of gradually but inexorably into a dictatorship. And this, I think, is very clearly observed, and that, I think, and perpetually relevant. And then after a number of years, in 1960, events change and they come out of it, perhaps not wonderfully, completely plausibly, but very interestingly. The other thing about these books is that they've got great narrative momentum. They've got a light touch. She's a bit of a joker, so it's comedy, but but there's also darkness. And judging by the way in which they keep getting borrowed from my local library when I wanted to use them, I'd say that they've got a big readership, even though people outside SF don't seem to know about them.
Mm.
Jo Walton's got a good reputation in the field. She's won at least one Hugo Award for Best Novel, and the works that I've read of Walton's I really quite enjoy. I think she's quite an excellent writer and worth watching, so this is worthwhile looking for.
She also wrote Among Others, which is about the readership of fandom, which is a fabulous book, and that deservedly won the World Fantasy.
Yeah, that is an excellent book. So when were these three written?
Well, she said that she wrote the first one within a very short period of time, over 19 days, and which shows because it's got great narrative momentum. And so 2006 to 2008, because one of her concerns was that the Gulf War, she felt, was sort of pushing England towards fascism, to which one might say little did she know. But I've seen some sniffy critical reviews of them, but on the whole, as I say, great popular reputation.
So what's been the major sniffy review critiques of it? What are they basically saying?
Well, okay. I noticed somebody, a male, thought the female characters weren't convincing. Sniff. I found them perfectly quite convincing. John Clute, he feels that that the ending, the last volume, is contrived. And particularly he had some doubts about the voice in that. But also, you know, apologies, John Clute, but I got the strong feeling from your review that you'd really, really wanted to read Michael Innes.
Yes, it's not really a good idea to always to review a book by saying, this isn't the book that I wanted to read. Well, not really with it, I think. David, have you read anything of Jo Walton's at this stage?
No, I don't think I have.
No, well, amongst others, as Lucy stated, I think you can I would really recommend you get to that. That's got to be like 20 years down the track before we get to that one in the Hugo time machine. So it is worthwhile. It is worthwhile having a look at and catching up at some stage. So Lucy, final thoughts. Did you think that the alternate histories worked?
They worked extremely well. They were all convincing. Burdekin's is genuinely terrifying. Walton has this lighter touch, but still manages to get in some very alarming stuff and has a lot of fun with, there's reference to Orwell, but he's written a book called 1974. And there's young Michael Foot in the Parliament, still a young Labour firebrand, and mention of that. Oh, that nice Kim Philby, who's got a job in the Foreign Office. So they've had to have a bit of fun.
I like little jokes like that, yeah. That's good. Yeah.
But at the same time, being extremely prodromic about the possibilities of fascism reasserting itself.
Yeah, which is a little bit of what we might be seeing at the moment. So, David, what about you? Which books did you decide to have a look at?
The book I read fairly recently, which is in this category of alternate histories where the Germans won the Second World War, is a book called Dominion by C.J. Sansom. Now, the only other books by C.J. Sansom I'd read before are a really excellent series of historical novels set in the declining days of Henry VIII and featuring the hunchback lawyer Matthew Shardlake. There's a whole series of those, and they're all extremely good. But this is quite different. So I was really quite intrigued to see that he'd written this, which is an alternate history novel which is set in Britain in the early 1950s. Now, the branching off point, because you've always got to sort of, in lots of these alternate histories, you've really kind of, it's always intriguing to know what was the splitting off point, you know, where did things start to go down the wrong trouser leg of time?
And I look at this as being the point of divergence, which I'll...
I like Terry Pratchett's... wrong trouser leg of time.
Yeah, that's good.
And anyway, in Dominion, the branching off point is, it starts off with the cabinet meeting in May 1940, in which Neville Chamberlain is telling the other ministers that he's going to step down as Prime Minister. In our history, of course, Winston Churchill agrees to take on the role. However, in this one, just kind of due to the dynamics of the meeting and the way the meeting goes, he doesn't agree to step forward, and Lord Halifax very reluctantly takes on the role and becomes Prime Minister. But with Halifax in charge, Britain seeks to have a peace treaty with Germany. So they agree on that peace treaty within a year. And then Germany is free to go on to dominate Europe. And Britain eventually just becomes a client state to the Third Reich. And by 1952, Adolf Hitler is dying, but Germany is still involved in a grinding, seemingly endless struggle against Russia, or in Russia. On the Eastern Front. So against this background in Britain, we follow the fortunes of a British public servant who's called David Fitzgerald. And he is kind of quietly opposed to the way the British government is bending over backwards for the Germans. And it turns out, in fact, that he, unbeknownst to himself for quite a while, actually had a Jewish mother. And by Jewish law, that makes David Fitzgerald also a Jew. So, of course, he's in immense peril if this is ever found out. So he's eventually recruited by the British resistance, which is being led in secret by an ailing Winston Churchill, who's still around, but he's not very well. And Churchill, of course, is by this stage considered public enemy number one by the people in power. So David Fitzgerald gets involved even further when they discover that someone he went to school with and sort of helped look after was a kind of mentally disturbed young man who's now in a mental asylum. And the reason he's in a mental asylum is that he's actually thrown his brother, this guy's thrown his brother out of the window after an argument and not quite killed him, but certainly injured him. But it turns out that this brother had been working in America and it was party to some deep secret that he passed on to this guy who's now in the mental asylum. And the resistance wants to stop the Germans getting hold of the secret, whatever it is. Eventually it turns out to be something to do with the nuclear bomb. So Fitzgerald is involved in kidnapping this guy from the mental asylum and trying to keep him safe for the Germans. So there's a lot of action around that, and it's complicated by the devastating London smog, I should say, of 1952. So there's a lot of moving around. People can't work out what the hell they are, where the hell they are, and it's a struggle. But it's quite a decent sort of action story, but nothing particularly deep or meaningful or giving you much more to think about than that. I mean, there's lots of stuff in there where the Jewish people in England are also starting to be rounded up by the British government to hand over to the Germans. And so you've got this sort of whole sort of very dark background. But yes, I didn't come away with it feeling anything. It really taught me anything much about the period or had any deeper insights than that. So it was a bit disappointing in that regard.
Not to the standard of the previous novels that you spoke about?
No, his historical novels, I think, are very good. They're all also kind of detective-y stories in the sense that Shardlake is often involved in solving some sort of mystery back in Tudor days. And they're all excellent. They do teach you, I think, a fair bit about the time period and the way people were thinking and so on. So yeah, I thought this was a bit disappointing. But it fitted into this category that we were going to talk about, so I thought we should mention it.
My wife's a big fan of those earlier mysteries, so yep. So that's why I was interested to find out what this one was like.
Sure. There is one other book I meant to mention or to go back and read if I could find a copy, but didn't, which is in this category, which is a book called The Iron Dream by Norman Spinrad. Have you read that? Yeah, a long time ago.
No, I haven't read it.
Yeah, it's kind of weird sort of background. It's actually a meta story, a story within a story, and the story within a story is an action adventure sort of being written by Adolf Hitler, who fled Germany to America and has become an illustrator of the covers of pulp magazines and is also writing pulp fiction as well. So, and then outside that, you have this sort of meta fiction of someone reviewing this book from a critic's point of view. It's an interesting book, but it's decades since I read it. So most of that comes from reading the summary in Wikipedia, but I thought we should mention it as part of this group of books of an altered history where something happens to Hitler. It's not quite what happened in our world. So I thought that was clever.
Spinrad actually has a lot of fun creating unreadable pulp prose.
Prose, yes.
It's not actually a great read.
But just fills it all out. That's rather amusing, because most of the rest of these ones were not overly amusing in general.
They're all pretty dark, yeah.
Lucy, I was interested that you were saying that the Joe Walton trilogy that you were talking about sort of harkens back to the golden age of the detectives, because two of the books that I wanted to talk about, SSGB by Len Deighton, which is written in 1978, and Fatherland by Robert Harris, which is written in 1992, which I believe you've read, David, just recently.
Just recently, yes, very good.
Both of these are crime novels that are inside an alternate history where the basic premise is that Hitler won the Second World War. Both of these have been made either into films or into TV series, which I'll bring up in a minute. SSGB, the point of divergence here, or the other trouser leg, is that Germany wins the Battle of Britain in 1940. Most people would realise that was a sort of a touch and go. And if you look back on it, you sort of think, you sort of can't work out why Britain actually won it. But anyway, in this instance, Germany wins the Battle of Britain. And so Britain is invaded and surrenders. The outcome is that Churchill was captured, tried and executed, we think. I mean, that's just a rumour that's in the book. There's no actual depiction of it. This book is set in 1964, following the overthrow of the British government in 1940. Now, the King's been captured and has been imprisoned in the Tower of London. Why he didn't leave, I'm not sure, but the royal family has escaped to New Zealand get as far away as they possibly can. The Russians still have a truce with Germany at this time, so that basically the Germans didn't invade Russia, and they are still only dealing with the UK. And because it's the Battle of Britain in 1940, this is prior to any entry of the Americans into the Second World War. And so basically Germany just runs over the top. Now, the plot of this particular book follows Douglas Archer, Archer of the Yard, really sort of gung-ho sort of guy that he is.
Dixon of Doc Green.
He's a British detective working for Scotland Yard, who's called in to investigate a murder. Now, he's been left in the position of being a police detective because he's good at his job. He's apolitical, and the Germans, generally the things are being run by the Luftwaffe or run by the German army. And of course the German army and the British army were half cousins, really, mostly. They trained together before the Second World War, and they all knew each other, and basically it was on an army basis, and so there wasn't any politics involved here. So the victim of this particular murder is identified as a British atomic scientist who's been working in the German atomic program, but is also a member of the resistance. This gradually comes up over the period. Of course, there is a resistance sort of running along underneath all the way right through. And Archer finds himself stuck between the German army and the Gestapo, who are brought in to help with the investigation. So they have a particular officer. I can never remember what the German officer's ranks always stand for, but he's basically major or colonel level, something like that. He's from the SS. He's brought in particular to run the investigation using Archer as his main detective. So Archer finds himself stuck between the resistance on one hand, because he's been having an affair with his secretary after his wife's died. He's been having an affair with his secretary, and he finds out his secretary's a member of the resistance. And then he finds out that his long-term offsider in the police force is also a member of the resistance. And then he finds out that just about everybody else in the police force is a member of the resistance except him. So he feels a little bit left out, but he's trying to be apolitical and just solve this particular murder. So he's dragged all over the place, and there's this higher level fight between the Gestapo on the one hand and the German army on the other. And it comes out that The two of them are trying to get as much information out of the British atomic program as they possibly can in order for them, that is, their side, and I mean their side, either the army or the Gestapo, because they're the ones that seem to be the ones that are loggerheads with each other. They're each trying to get to build their own bomb and therefore be able to take control and wipe out the other side, if you like. And I'm not talking about the Allied side. Again, I'm talking about either the army or the Gestapo. So this is quite a good detective story, and it's also quite a good extrapolation of what would happen to the atomic program in the UK when the Germans tried to take it over. There was a television series, a five 1 hour episodes of this made by the BBC in 2017, which I saw just recently, and it's fairly faithful to the book. It's quite a good depiction of what goes on in the book, and quite a good adaptation. I think the acting's good. Yes, you can see that some of the backgrounds are basically CGI'd in, but that's okay. I mean, it still looks pretty authentic and looks quite good. So yes, and I know that you, Lucy, you've read this or you've seen the TV series recently. What was your thing? Did you think of
Lovely
it?
bit of design because it's very noir,
Yes.
and the acting's good, and the period feel not too anachronistic. It's a really stylish piece of TV.
It does look really good. The actors, they've picked some very good actors in the roles. It's got a lot of tension in it, and I would suggest that if you haven't had a chance to see it yet, that you certainly do so. And I would also suggest that you read this book because I think this one's quite good. It just seemed to have got lost. Dighton used to write, he wrote The Ipcress File, so that series of books that were turned into films with Michael Caine, where the character in the films was called Harry Palmer, but in the books didn't have a name at all. So they were quite interesting. So he's got quite a pedigree of writing sort of spy mystery works, and inside this particular alternate history, it really works quite well. And I'd suggest people read this one. On the other hand, so basically, this is a detective series set inside, or a detective story set inside Britain after Hitler has won the war. The other side of things is Fatherland by Robert Harris, which is set in Germany or in around Berlin, which is also a detective story set in a world in which Hitler has won the Second World War. So basically, the way that this happens is that one of the major Nazi officers, Reinhard Heydrich, survives an assassination attempt on him in May 1942 and becomes the head of the SS. So this guy's a bit of a hard ass, to put it bluntly. Basically, Joseph Kennedy in the US is not doesn't lose his reputation over the way that he deals with Britain and Germany in the Second World War, and he actually becomes president of the United States in 1960. So he's there in 1960, and this book is set in 1964. So he's coming up for re-election. But the other major point of divergence in this particular book is that the Enigma codes were scrapped at one point because Germany realised that the Brits had learned how to crack the codes. And because of that, basically, the U-boats were able to do whatever they wanted. Britain couldn't hold out and surrendered in 1944. Now, the outcome of this is that King George the Sixth, the royal family, and Churchill have all fled to Canada. Edward the Eighth, is it Edward the Eighth, regains the throne with Wallace Simpson. Was he eighth or seventh?
Edward the Eighth,
Edward
yeah.
the Eighth. So he's put back into the throne with Wallace Simpson as his queen, because the rumour was that Edward and Wallace Simpson were basically Nazi sympathisers, majorly. And Germany signed a truce with the US after the defeat of Japan. So basically, the US doesn't come in to help the UK out. The same thing happens in the Asia Pacific region as happens in our timeline. But basically, Germany signs a truce with the US after Japan's defeated, and basically has control of the whole of the whole of the UK. But none of this is really set in the UK. This is all set in Berlin. Now, Europe is now controlled by Germany right across from all the way through from the UK right through to into Russia, although there's still an ongoing war with the Russians as it goes. But most of Europe is run by a European Parliament, which is basically a puppet of the of the German government. Now, the plot of this particular book is that a group of high-ranking Nazis who attended the Wannsee Conference in 1942, now this is where Germany decided on the final solution for what they for the Jewish problem. This is where that was all agreed. Now, these high-ranking German officials are dying in mysterious circumstances. One drowns, one has a heart attack. Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And our detective in this case, Xavier March, of the criminal police, again, it's the criminal police, not the political police, is brought in to investigate and realizes where this is leading, and then finds that the Gestapo are trying to basically take control of his investigation. He is attempting to try and break this all down to clean it all up. The high-ranking Nazis want to make sure this is all swept under the carpet and that the basic secret of the final solution doesn't come out, because Joseph Kennedy is about to visit Germany on a diplomatic mission before the elections in 1964. And really, this is all about hiding evidence of the Holocaust from everybody else, because that hasn't come out at all in the intervening years. A good mystery. But if I was to rank the two, I would say that SSGB is better than this, but that's just my opinion. But you've read this, David. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I just finished reading it really a couple of days ago. I haven't read SSGB, so I can't really compare it, but I thought it was a very I thought Fatherland was a very powerful story. It was it's really quite a good detective story. Oh, it's kind of a noirish sort of feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it's this whole business of the detective getting in deeper and deeper into things he didn't really quite understand at first, and being betrayed by people and so on. And the ending where which we're going to give away if I do this, but the ending where the secrets of that conference and the German method of dealing with the Jews, those documents actually come out. And I see that the author says that these are actually all the authentic documents that he's quoting from. It's not like he's making that part of it up, and it's horrifying that the approach the Germans were taking to getting rid of the Jews. And so that was pretty powerful, I thought, towards the end.
It's a look, the two of them, SSGB and Fatherland, are an interesting combination, but if you read them close together, you start seeing some interesting little similarities. Namely, one of them, in each novel, one of the major characters is a US journalist, good looking, of course, who has a relationship with the detective. And you sort of think, well, Fatherland was written in 1992, SSGB 1978. Did Harris read SSGB beforehand? Not sure. Let's say that he didn't, just to be kind to him. But it is interesting that they've got similar sorts of plot devices that they're utilizing in these two, but I'd recommend reading both of these. I think these are quite good, and it's a good usage or a good exploration of how the alternate history flows and how it works and how it sort of seeps down into all parts of society and what happens with the politics when you get down to a murder mystery which is really steeped in politics and in a lot of times in the science, as it is with SSGB. I think these both work very well.
Would you say that with Fatherland, because I haven't read the other one, would you say that in either case the story would work without the alternate history setting, if it was just set in a modern day sort of set scenario?
I don't think it'd have the same impact, because it's that extra layering of mystery or conflict above just the murder mystery itself. And the layers above it are in SSGB, it's between the army, German army on one side and the Gestapo on the other, or the SS on the other. And in Fatherland, it is between the criminal police and the political police fighting each other. Without those two things going as well, you don't get the same sort of stuff. This is very similar to things like if you have a look at a lot of detective series set in our timeline. Take Bosch, for example, for the series set in LA. You've got basically Bosch is this sort of slight maverick LA detective. Most of these are police procedurals, and he's always fighting with people above him or other agencies. So he's always got that extra level of conflict that's going on. Most of these basically end up having fights with that. Ian Rankin's Detective Rebus always has trouble with other parts of the police force who are basically trying to investigate him all the time because they don't like his techniques and the way he goes about doing things. You've got that base level of the mystery and how that's detected, but also that extra layer of the conflict which is impacting on top of it because it's going to the particular person. And in that instance, both of those would need that layer of conflict above them. You could do it, but they would be vastly different novels.
Yeah, well, certainly Fatherland, now that I think about it, Fatherland wouldn't work without that sort of horrendous background that is being covered up by the all these people who are being knocked off, all these people who attended that conference being knocked off. It would be hard to make a modern equivalent or a non-alternate history equivalent, I suppose, of that.
Now, the other book I wanted to talk about was The Plot Against America by Philip Roth, which was written in 2004. This actually won, I think Dominion won the Sidewise Award, and so did
Right.
this particular novel. This isn't a Hitler won the Second World War, but it's sort of associated to it because it's a bit like it. Well, it takes the point of divergence where Charles Lindbergh, the aviator, is a surprise Republican candidate in 1940, and he wins the 1940 presidential election in a landslide, and he's running on an isolationist platform. He easily defeats FDR, so the US signs a peace treaty with both Germany and Japan. So there's no Pearl Harbor in 1941, but the US doesn't support Britain during the Battle of Britain with food and supplies, and so basically Britain just is overrun, well, almost overrun. Basically, Germany is sort of beating the hell out of them, but the Americans have moved more towards a fascist style of government. Just a few things that you could read into this as to what's happening now, but this book was written in 2004. Now, the plot follows the early life of Philip Roth. It's a novel. He uses his own character, his own name as the main character in this particular book. And I think I've got to I've worked out why he's particularly done that later on, and I'll explain that a bit later. And it deals with the steady rise of anti-Semitism in the US after the election of Lindbergh. The entire Jewish families are slowly being relocated from the East Coast over to the Western and Southern US. So they're moving them all into one particular area. So this is a sort of like a precursor to what might be happening later on. And that carries on for a couple of years. Things gradually build, and some of the building up is quite well handled. And then on October the 7th, 1942, Lindbergh, who basically still liked flying his plane around everybody, being the gung-ho aviator that he wants to be, the plane goes missing and the body's never found. Now, the vice president steps up. He was an ex-Democrat, but he's very right-wing ex-Democrat, and he's really gone very much right wing to the point where he's really an anti-Semite, and he imposes martial law because he basically says there's all these conspiracy theories about the fact that either Lindbergh crashed his ship out at sea and was picked up by a submarine. And I read that and I thought, hang on, didn't that happen here? 1960, wasn't whatever it was with Harold Holt. I thought that's a bit weird. I don't know whether Philip Roth ever heard of Harold Holt, but anyway,
It hasn't very much.
I thought that was amusing. I found that a little bit close to home. I thought that was good. But also that there's the idea that the Canadians have got him, that the Jews have got him, there's all these conspiracy theories that how could he possibly have disappeared? You know, he can't just have disappeared. Somebody's actually kidnapped him, which is a sort of a reflection or a carry-on of the kidnapping of Lindbergh's son a few years before in the 1930s. So this is the second kidnapping. And there's even conspiracy theories which are raised in the book about how both Lindbergh and his son were kidnapped by the Germans because the Germans were happy that Lindbergh had done all that he needed to do and therefore they could move him on. It's a bit thin. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the Lindbergh's wife, who's still there, comes out and says, no, we shouldn't have all this. And there's a whole lot of stuff happens very quickly, which I don't think is covered very well in the book. There's an emergency 1942 presidential election, which FDR wins, and it all goes back to what it was before.
Okay.
And so I came out to the end of this and I thought, he was really unconfident about how this idea would be taken. Now, I seem to remember reading somewhere that in one particular interview, Roth had this idea that he had invented a whole new subgenre.
It just shows he was illiterate.
Well, it just shows that he wasn't widely read in any particular areas and that he had felt that this hadn't been done before. If that's the case, and that actually follows from my theory about this particular book, in that he was so unconfident about how it was going to be taken that he put his own name as the character and only allowed the alternate history to run for 2 years and didn't extend it any further because he thought, well, my readers are just not going to basically accept that this could carry on. Okay. No, I don't quite get that. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So he doesn't have a lot of confidence in his own work and he doesn't have a lot of confidence in the history that he's basically put together until the point where he says, no, I've just got to drag this back in and snap the whole timelines back to where it needs to be and then everything's hunky-dory again. There's a lot of interesting things in this, but we've spoken before, David, about Connie Willis and about how much she puts a large amount of information in about all the little bits and pieces around the edges. So you can see all of her research. I found it a bit tedious when for a page and a half he listed everybody that went to a presidential ball. I don't quite get why you would do that. And then, yeah, it is. It's a really weird info dump. And then he talks about the neighbourhood. And he will talk about somebody living next door and that person's cousin. And then he'll give you a potted history of that person's cousin's life. Mm. And you never hear from that person again. And they don't impact the novel at all. And you just feel, he just really hasn't kept this going. So there's that forward momentum you were talking about earlier, Lucy, about Joe Walton, where there's this drive and forward momentum. It isn't in this book, really. You're reading it just to get that little bit of the history where you don't really care about what happens to the people that are there, which is a bit disappointing. So I thought this was the poorest of the books, actually, that I read. So, although supposedly a major book, but it didn't really get there for me. Lucy?
I just wanted to comment that Jo Walton was asked about her, what she had read in this subgenre, and she was specifically asked about Roth and about Philip K. Dick, and she said she hadn't read either because she hadn't liked other books by them.
Yeah, she doesn't like Philip K. Dick at all. She stated that in her history of the Hugo Awards. She basically says, well, she tried reading one Philip K. Dick book, didn't like it, and then has refused to read any others, which always sort of strikes me as a bit, well, I don't know. Well, that actually brings us to the major book that we wanted to have a look at the end, which all three of us have read at some time or other. I've read it really quite recently, and that is The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick, which won the 1963 Hugo Award, written in 1962, considered to be one of the major books in the SF field. You did have read this recently, haven't you, David?
Very recently. I started rereading it yesterday afternoon and this morning.
Oh, okay. That's pretty good.
All right. Well, I'll try to give a bit of a summary, but it's certainly it's considered one of the most influential books, I think, in this genre that's been written. So The Man in the High Castle. So it's set in the 1960s, sort of contemporary with when it's being written. But it's in a timeline where Germany and Japan won the war. And the splitting off point is not quite clear, but it seems to be there was talk of the assassination of Franklin Roosevelt. someone shot him. And I think that's maybe the splitting off point, but I'm not sure that's exactly
right.
Yeah,
I've got that. It was him. He was assassinated in 1934.
Yeah, yeah.
There was an actual incident where he was an attempt was made, and the guy was executed for it, he missed FDR, shot somebody else who later died, and the guy was then done on murder charge and executed.
You see, I should have done that research to find that out. Anyway, but that's the basic scenario. The Germans and the Japanese won the war, and what's happened is that they've split the North America into zones, and the Pacific zone is under the control of the Japanese, who won the Pacific War. And the East Coast, all the big cities like New York and so on, are under the control of the Germans. And in the middle is this sort of neutral area, which is the Rocky Mountain states, but they're pretty much still under the thumb of each side there. And the book starts with a guy who runs a store, selling antique American objects to Japanese. And it's quite an interesting way to start, because we see how, because at this point we don't know anything about the background, it's quite an interesting way to start because we see very quickly the subservience of this character, Robert Childen, who runs this store, to his Japanese customers, and how he has to be, he's very conscious of not losing face and not losing place and with these customers. And the Americans are certainly meant to feel inferior to the superior Japanese, who now kind of run half the country. And he's been asked to provide a gift for some personage who's about to visit, a Mr. Tagomi, who's a Japanese trade consul of some kind. And this personage turns out to be a Mr. Baines, who's ostensibly a Swedish industrialist coming to discuss injection molding technology with the Japanese. But it turns out that he's, in fact, traveling undercover. He's actually a dissident German, and he's wanting to pass on a very, really desperate message to the Japanese authorities about the plans that the Germans have for the Japanese. And it's quite easy to understand, really, when you think about the German sense of racial superiority, and anyone who isn't of Aryan descent and has any colour to their skin or whatever are seen as inferior by the Germans. And you can see, you can imagine in this sort of situation where you have half the world divided between these two great nations, the Germans may well want to get rid of the Japanese. And indeed, that's the plan. There's a plan called Operation Dandelion, which is basically the plan to H-bomb the Japanese home islands on a pretext. And so he's there to try and pass this on, and there's a whole lot of detail about how that message gets passed on. We also have a character called Frank Frink, who's, what would you say, a mechanic, who has been working for a company which is making fake antique weapons like Civil War guns and so on, some of which are sold in Robert Children's store. And he gets fired and starts off with a mate to start making jewellery and sell these contemporary jewellery. And we also have his wife, Juliana, from whom he's separated, who is living in the Rocky Mountain states. And she meets up with an Italian truck driver called Joe Cinadello. And she meets up with him and sort of starts travelling with him. There's also two other major characters which are actually not people, they're books, two major characters which appear in this novel. And the first of these important books is the I Ching, which is the Chinese oracle, fortune-telling oracle. And a lot of the characters consult the oracle at various points to find out, to get advice and to see what the future holds for them. And the other very important book is one called The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, which is a novel. And in this novel, which has been written by an author called Hawthorne Abinson, in this novel, it's an alternate history novel. And in the novel, Germany and Japan lose the Second World War. So there's this real self-referential feel to it. The interesting thing, though, is that the world depicted in The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, the timeline depicted, isn't quite our timeline, not the real timeline. It's just a bit off, but that's the basic sense of it, that Germany and Japan lose the war. And so it's quite a subversive book, and the Germans have banned it, and anyone in possession of it, because it's in big trouble. Whereas in the Japanese-controlled territories, it's pretty well freely available. So I'm not sure quite how to depict the rest of the plot, but the business about this character coming to visit Mr. Tagomi gets to the point where the Germans are desperate to stop this contact happening, and in fact send a couple of goons into to the meeting that Mr. Baines is having with Mr. Tagomi and a Japanese a general who's come undercover to for this meeting. And Tagomi takes out an antique gun he has, which I think he was bought from Robert Children's store, and shoots dead these two goons who come in. And this has huge psychic impact on him, and he becomes deeply distressed. And he then has a kind of out-of-body experience, not quite an out-of-body experience, has a kind of weird experience where he seems to have drifted into our world, into our timeline, and then back again to his own timeline. So then, I suppose the culminating part of the book is that Juliana Fink, who's traveling with this Joe Cinedella, he's really keen to meet up with this author who wrote The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, and she's not. It's just they just want to go and talk to him and get him to sign a book. But it turns out that Cinedella, in fact, is undercover too. He's really a German soldier, and he's there to assassinate this author. So she manages to defeat his plot, but I won't go into any more detail. That pretty much covers the breadth of the story, I think. But it's really interesting, and it ends. I think still think it ends in a really sort of strange way when Juliana finally meets up with the author of The Grasshopper Lies Heavy and confronts him, and she says to him, "What was the role of the I Ching in the writing of this book?" And he says, "No, it had nothing to do with it." But it turns out that in fact he based the entire book, The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, on the promptings of the oracle, the I Ching. But he's very resistant to that, and then they sort of do a bit of more oracle casting, and I won't go into any more detail. But it ends, I think, oddly. What do you think about it?
Lucy, what did you
I
think?
used to be well, I was a really big fan of some but not all of Philip K. Dick's books, and in fact have written a story called K and Phyllis, what would have happened if Philip K. Dick had spectrally met Catherine Burdekin, which is completely impossible, but they enter into their imagined worlds because they're having a kind of contest as to who influenced who and who's got the better idea. And I had quite a lot of fun doing it, but I would it's not, when you look at Dick now, he's not a stylist because he was writing in the pulp tradition. He was writing immense wordage, which he took speed to deal with. But it's very quotable. There's a line which Tagomi says, he's listening to a summary of German policy, and he goes, "There is evil, it's actual, like cement." And that line has stuck with me. The other interesting thing about this book is that it's character driven in a way. Well, it's got a several plot lines. One internet source says it's got a spy plot line, and it's got an arts and craft plot line, and they all meet up. It is about the interaction of characters with each other. And so there's particularly daft moments when Hugo Reiss, who's one of the Viewpoint characters, he's the German consul in San Francisco, and he's secretly reading the Grasshopper Lies Heavy underneath his desk, and he keeps on being interrupted to his great annoyance, which is a wonderful piece of comic writing. And it's all of these characters are to some degree ambivalent. And they have facets of them. They do things you don't expect, which is partly because Dick claimed that he too used the I Ching to predict what to plot the book. So it's a very self-referential device. And so this is a really interesting approach because you get drawn into the characters in a way that you shouldn't theoretically in a pulp book. But Ursula Gwynne was very fond of of Togomi, for instance, as a character because he's just an everyman. He's just a, you know, he's just a public service functionary. And so these are ordinary people who under extraordinary circumstances draw out immense fortitude and abilities that they didn't know existed. So it's an interesting one. It's been commented that Philip K. Dick, because he makes really good screen, he's got into the intersections of popular culture that people, he's everywhere in the same way as you might say Lovecraft is, and that with even if you haven't read a word of him, you're very aware of that he's of his thought. And one of his is that reality is mutable, and this is what I would say about this book, that it's his constant theme that reality is mutable, and you can have drug induced or you can have alternative timelines, you can briefly see what the truth is, but it's not necessarily what you think it is. And I do think it stands up. It's had a screen series which departed from the book.
Greatly departed from the book.
Yeah, and I think I noticed that some of these screen adaptations are very interested in the notion of resistance to fascism. I wonder why. And one final thing is that there's a little point of influence that I think might show where Burdekin influenced Dick, in that she has a samurai briefly mentioned in Swastika Night, who's fascinated by American popular culture and collects popular songs and has preserved the song Shenandoah for something like hundreds of years because he writes it down. And that's an aspect that I think could have triggered off things in Dick, but as I say, it's just a speculation. But yeah, I think as a book, it stands up.
There are some really moving things. That whole distress that Togomi has after he's killed these two people is very well depicted, I think, and you really feel for this character, as you say, who's been a pretty much an ordinary sort of trade representative bureaucrat sort of person, and thrown into these extraordinary circumstances and having to take action, which is very violent, which is very much against his nature, but nevertheless was required at the moment. And that's quite a moving part of the book, I think. But you're right, there's also some really comic things. I mean, one of the eventual gift that Robert Chilton gets for Togomi to give to Mr. Baines, because Chilton doesn't know that Baines is not a Japanese, that this visitor to Togomi isn't Japanese. So the gift he eventually gives him is an antique Mickey Mouse watch. And when Baines gets this, he goes, "What?" Turns to himself, "What the heck is this?" Doesn't say anything. It's all is about keeping face and not losing place. There's some funny stuff in it too, I think. What do you think, Perry?
I really enjoyed this book because I like the way the interplay of all the four or five different character lines all flows all the way through, and the connections, and you think, well, where are they going to join up again? Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But the whole conceit of this being an alternate history novel with another alternate history novel embedded in the middle of it really is something that nobody else had done previously, as far as I'm aware, and it really just sets the whole thing off and lifts it above the ruck of anything, a lot of other stuff that was being written in the early 60s. And this isn't your standard SF space opera, planetary romance, adventure novel. This is a good modern novel. That's it. It's just a good modern novel. It does what it needs to do. Yeah, you could say that the ending's a little bit, you're not terribly sure about it, but I was satisfied with it. I thought that it was okay. I was wondering, there's not many other ways you could end it without everybody getting blown up.
Well, true, yeah. I mean, it's very enigmatic, really, the ending, isn't it? Because she just...
To figure out, and, you know...
Sort of, yeah, figures it out and then goes out and leaves him.
And as you said, there's the timeline that he depicts in the major part of the novel. And then there's the alternate timeline, which is in The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, and neither of those are ours. So is any of those three the truth, or is it just basically an amalgam of all of them? I thought it was good. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
It's a very enjoyable book.
And I think it's probably the best of the alternate histories, especially set around that sort of idea about the Second World War that I've read. Lucy?
I'd also make the point that if Dick is now being taken seriously as a great American modern novelist, then this is one of the books on which that reputation lies. And it's a lot more accessible to non-science fiction readers than a lot of his work.
Absolutely.
Because of its insight into character, I think.
The characters were certainly well depicted, I thought.
All right. I think we've basically had as much to say as we need to about that. Thank you very much, Lucy. Thank you very much, David, for being here and discussing all this. It's been a pleasant and interesting discussion, and hopefully it provides a bit of food for thought for our listener, who can go off and find some books to read. So, David, that's another episode in the can, which is good. Good topic. We should think about doing a chat with other people regarding other SF themes at some point.
Mm-hmm.
First contact, time travel, that sort of stuff, sometime down the track. But I think next episode we should get back to what other stuff we've been reading lately or watching. We've been a little while since we've covered anything other than our set topics that we've had. Mm. So the next one will be a little bit more freeform.
Mm.
So give you an opportunity to go through all those ebooks that you've been working
backlist.
On and tell us all about those. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, David. And thanks very much to Lucy for being a part of today's episode. And we'll see the listener in 2 weeks.
See
you then.
See you then.
Bye.